Brigadier Calvert Reel 7.
Yes, I was saying that what I advocated later on, looking on all these experiences, that if there's a special force or penetration force or a SAS force operating in a divisional or corps or even army area, there should be a staff officer representing them to advise the commander, just like you have a CRA, a CRE, or and others, because otherwise either they're not catered for, not looked after properly, and are not used within their limits, or the commander has to spend all his time at headquarters and cannot lead and train his men in action. So, and I think this has now been adopted with the SAS. It's now been realized that you must have this. I've advocated this in lectures again and again, and I think it has borne fruit. Because, for instance, when Dusuntur was about 15 miles away from Kuala Lumpur, and the road to and from, there'd been ambushes on it, and people had been killed and so on. So if I wanted to go into headquarters, I would have to go along there. In actual fact, I never would take an escort. But it was dangerous and added to the strain. Now I'll finish up by in a lighter mood of possibly my most embarrassing thing that ever happened, and how it might have been one of the deeds which lost the empire. I had been in the jungle with my squadron for 6 weeks, and in Pera, P-E-R-A-K, deep Pera, going up by boat and seeing them all, doing this, that, and the other. I came out, and I was asked to dinner with the governor and one or two of the top people on the governmental side. And I had this excellent dinner. I literally come out of the jungle the night before. Well, when you're sleeping in a hammock, you have the hammock as canvas underneath, or as a light, the modern American hammock, very, very light, weighs only about 3 pounds. And you have a waterproof cover over the top, and this is attached to the hammock which you sleep in by a mosquito net with a zip fastener, so you can hang your hammock, and it can rain like hell and you don't get out of your hammock. Now if you want to urinate during the night, all you need do is to open the zip a little bit, lean on one side, and you can urinate onto the ground, and with the rain and everything, it's of course quickly washed away. And so this was, I might say, common practice. Well, I had this dinner, and we had the it was very successful. I was getting all the things I wanted done, and they agreed to this, and I'd won them over to our side. And then I wasn't drunk or anything, but we drank a lot of fine wines and things. And then I went to beautiful bedroom. I woke up at about 6 a.m. and thought, where the hell am I? I realized a white, beautiful white mosquito net, and suddenly some horror struck me. And I looked on the ground, and sure enough, there was a puddle there. And I got up in my dressing gown, and I went downstairs, and I found out the room below mine was the billiard room. And there was a great stain right in the center of the ceiling and onto the billiard table. And there was the number one Chinese boy looking at me impassively. And so I told him, I said, please tell the governor that I've been hauled away on a very vital thing. And so all, I mean, I've been worked up to this vital moment when I could have got everything I wanted done. I fled. I was too embarrassed. I didn't know how to talk myself out of it. So see how some minor thing may, I say, have changed the history of the British Empire.
Could I just go back to one or two things you've
Yes.
said? You said previously about rivalry between the army and the police, which rather surprised me in Malaya, because I would have thought that their work would have been complementary rather than in a state of rivalry.
There were police. It was due to, you might say, it was early days. This was before Cyprus, before Ireland, before anything of that nature. And these were a lot of. There'd been a great influx of policemen from Palestine. And the a lot of the Malay police had been prisoners of war. And when I say rivalry, I'd say disagreement, possibly. They hadn't learned to work with each other. The special branch, I thought, was very good indeed, and I was in touch with special branch all the time. But the police think of things as, they used to think of things purely as a crime. And a crime has to be committed before you can go chasing after people. And whereas I was trying to anticipate crimes being committed and going for the originators. And so I was going to the places which are called, I got the word just now. Can't remember. I may think of it before I go.
You're talking about the Malay regiment being so bad. In what way were they particularly bad?
Well, they had, of course, had remained behind, a lot of them remained behind in Malaya. They'd been influenced a lot by the Japanese, and they hadn't got any great willingness to go into the jungle. We used to call them the Hookworm Regiment. They were lethargic and lack of interest into going, doing anything. I think, looking back on it, I've probably been a bit unfair of them because they had only been sort of reformed after the war, and their officers possibly weren't the best officers from the British Army. There may have been some people who just wanted a nice, pleasant rest. But they weren't good. Later they did become good, but only to a certain extent after they'd been dewormed. And I may be prejudiced. I probably am prejudiced on this. I thought that the British troop were the best. I thought the Gurkhas were very good. The KOYLI, for instance, were very, very good indeed. There were some other regiments who were very good. It just depends where they wanted to operate. I don't know whether I've told the story about the right out with the Scots Guards. Did I tell you this?
About how you reported the CO to
That's
Hardy.
right, yes, that's
Yes,
right.
you have.
Yes, well, of course, those are only incidents, but General Harding wanted to know these things because he was determined to do it. And I met General Poet introducing me when I gave a lecture once. He said, very kindly, I say this as a compliment to myself, how the whole atmosphere changed once I was teaching the SAS and using the SAS, forming and teaching the SAS and well, SAS Malayan Scouts, and then how it produced a sense of rivalry and everybody else wanted to emulate what we were doing. And people realized they could stay in the jungle and for long times and do this, and that they could forget about parade ground soldiering. And he said it had a almost immediate effect throughout the whole operations there. it was the beginning of our defeat of the Chinese guerrillas.
Coming back again to the Malay Regiment, one, I was a bit surprised about their lack of enthusiasm for going into the jungle, because one would have thought that in view of what you said about the political situation with their relations with the Chinese, that they would have been keen to destroy the Chinese guerrillas.
The Malay Regiment wasn't. You want to differentiate between the Sultans, who were rather like the Normans, and the Malays, who had peace, British Empire peace for over 130 years, and you can condemn war, but it does keep a country up to the mark. The Malays were a lazy regiment, and it is known, of course, or lazy people. This was known by all businessmen. Result that they got in Indians and Chinese to do all the rubber tapping and to run the tin mine, which is the main source of production in Malaya, and also to do all the clerical work and all the business work. And the Malays, very charming people, nice people, like the Burmese, didn't like working. They hadn't got the work ethic at all. They didn't see the point of making profit. And there it was. It's the same where in other places where we've introduced Chinese or Indians to do the work. It was done in Queensland. It was done in the Canadian Pacific Railway was built by Chinese, they found, and we now know the situation in Fiji. The Malays were lazy people, charming lazy people.
What exactly did you mean by the influence of the Japanese?
Well, the influence was that they'd been defeated, and they lost respect for the British. There was tremendous loss of respect for the British due to the Japanese victories in the early parts of the war. And in Malaya, we never had an opportunity to reconquer Malaya. The British were very anxious to do this, and were just to, so as we recovered our respect in that part of the world, but we never did completely.
Were you in a position whilst you were in Malaya to make any kind of assessment about how much genuine support there was for the Chinese guerrillas from the civilian population?
There was support. Well, I'll tell you the real reason, which one. We were going to give the Malaya independence. And the people who worked out the terms of independence were very pro-Malay, and they were disenfranchising the Chinese, i.e. the only people who could vote would be the Malays and some Chinese. And the result is the Chinese, who had fought for us in the war, had a very big chip on their shoulder that they were being disenfranchised. And so there was a lot of support right from the business circles, in the Chinese business circles, down to the Chinese tapper. The Chinese tappers supported the guerrillas, and the Briggs plan, which was really Sir Robert Thompson's method, was to separate the Chinese tappers, and they were put into these sort of concentration camps to prevent the guerrillas getting food from them and getting information from them and everything else. And that was one of the methods which the guerrillas were finally defeated. Remember, it took 14 years to defeat them. And that 14 years, I've often wondered, had a very great effect in reducing Britain from a first-class power to a second-class power, because we had, with including the Malays, we had something like 60,000 troops there. And the Chinese guerrillas, and I think I've mentioned this point before, but it's rather like in an orchard. There's only a certain number of trees in an orchard, and that is the optimum. And so it is the optimum in a guerrilla force. And Chin Peng presumably decided that it was somewhere between 5,000 and 7,000. There were just that number of men whom he could feed and that number of targets. And so that was the optimum. Yet those 5,000 to 7,000 were there for 14 years. And they took up all our activities during that period, to the detriment of British and influence in other parts of the world. And I think it's not often realized by historians what effect that had. Another effect it had was the modern form of dancing. The way you dance nowadays, as opposed to the ballroom dancing, it came from Malaya. And also from Indochina, where you don't touch each other because it's too hot. And it was introduced, there were all these young men, conscripts, going out there. And they did very well. But they also brought this type of dancing and type of music back to Britain and all over the world. They, about the conscripts, you could tell how long a person had been out, and I used to train people that in the jungle, in slippery jungle, you cannot walk heel and toe. You have to walk with knees bent. Now, if you try walking across a room with your eyes shut, you'll walk with your knees bent. You're walking from one safe base to another, you see. You're walking on the flat of your foot, and you can feel around like this, you see. And we found out that I could tell how long people had been in the jungle by the way they walked. And it's amazing how people from Manchester, Liverpool, east end of London, so adapted themselves to the jungle if they were allowed to. I say if they were allowed to. If they weren't made to attend parades and things like that in barracks.
But coming back to popular support for the guerrillas, yes. Did their communist ideology prove off-putting, do you think, to the Chinese?
The Chinese had a great loyalty to their motherland, whatever they like to call it. And I have been in China before the war, and it really was horrific, the expectation of life at birth was 21. There was disease everywhere, amongst the children with their eyes and so on like that, and absolute poverty and thing. And I say that, I'm not pro-communist, but anything was better than their situation. In actual fact, I should say China is one place where communism did a lot of good. It improved the health of the people right the way throughout, and also the starvation feeding. But that wasn't known at the time. This was just after the war. And I think that the Chinese in Malaya, mainly from South China and Hainan Island, and they still had a lot of contacts, and they used to send their money back to China, even after three or four generations, and would often go back there to be buried. I think they were still, they might have been anti-communist, but they were still pro-China. they weren't a violently racialist group. They want to get on with everybody because they're mainly traders. But they did object to the way the, and I think they're objecting now, the way the sultans used to try to run them down. Of course, Singapore, which is 90% Chinese, wouldn't join the Malayan Federation.
Now, going back to the earlier part interview that we did on the Second World War, two things arose from that, which I wondered if you could enlarge on. One was your meeting with Commander Drage in Australia.
Yes.
You did touch on that, but you didn't really give much detail about it. And could you explain what was the transaction between the two of you at that time?
Well, the main thing was, this is the interest you've chosen this. I didn't know whether Colonel Moorhead, I was trying to be loyal to him all the time, and I think I mentioned how I, when he talked about the Japanese building 60,000 ton battleships and so on like that, I wasn't quite certain whether to believe him, and certainly the Australian government, I don't think, did believe him. There was this row, political row, which I have mentioned, in Australia, and I suppose, although I try to keep out of it, Australians tried to influence me and say what about this man Moorhead? And I, looking back on it, Moorhead stood up for me all the time, and perhaps I was doubtful about some of the things occurring, and he was being accused. I think I told you how he was, I had to hide him, and then he was released and so on like that. And I wanted to talk to somebody about it, and I was asked to go to Northern Australia, to Darwin, and where Drage met me. And all I did was, I'd known of Drage, known him slightly before the war, in China, and I just told him everything I could. I said that I don't know whether I'm speaking the truth or what. This is my viewpoint, and but this is the situation. And so I just told him everything I could think of. And when I met him in
Darwin?
Kensington, no, it was in the 70s, he always reminded me of this meeting in Darwin. We'd come out with a naval officer too, a British naval officer, and he rather ran down, he was a very, very correct chap, he rather ran down Moorhead. Moorhead was an awkward position. He'd been chosen. He had come from MI5, I think it was, not MI6. And they'd made him a lieutenant colonel just to make him in charge of the mission. But of course he'd know nothing about the army, and he would always refer things to me, and he, you know, in a nice way, and I try and help him as much as I could. But this is why he became under suspicion. he was an intelligence officer par excellence. But the Australians are a very militaristic race, really. And when he didn't know this and didn't know that and didn't know something like that, they had their doubts about him tremendously. When I went out to Australia only just a few years ago, the subject of Morgan came up. And then I was asked to write an article for their United Services Institute magazine. And I remember Sir Bernard Callanan, who is now a very big shot in Australia, he said, you can write an article, you needn't mention Morehead. It's a rather surprising remark he made. And I have a feeling they thought that Morehead, that a part of our mission was to spy on Australia. I didn't know, quite wrong, I was very young, I just didn't know, and it was very nice. And if you remember, I said, when I got to Singapore, coming out of, at the end of the mission there, I talked to the chief intelligence officer who later became military attaché to China. I can't remember his name just offhand. He'd adopted two children, I remember. And I talked all night to him in Singapore, and then next morning he got on me again, and they took down in shorthand what I'd said about our mission there. And I said, now look, I'm making these provisos all the time because I just didn't know. It was the way the New Zealanders had been kicked out under a false row. It was a row between Australia and New Zealand. I think in any formation of special force, they're always liable to be these strains. It's probably a good thing in a way, because that you've got to have very strong convictions in order to fight it through. But I've often thought that is the answer. If it is easy to make a special force, there'd be far too many of them, and they'd be no good. But remember, one must get into the atmosphere of the times. This is 1940, 41, when we'd been defeated everywhere, everything. And so people were grasping at straws, and they were suspicious, and they were worried about, I suppose nuns are supposed to have arrived. I mean, German parachutists disguised as nuns. And the Australians had their doubts as to whether we mightn't have been a highly clever Nazi organization. it's quite funny, but the people we worked with didn't. I mean, soon